Follow the White Rabbit is a game that will teach you practical politics. Practical politics is called practical politics because it is non-voting, which makes it very, very practical. Conventional politics is, of course, rule-based politics, which is what you do at the voting booth. It's very, very rule-based and timeline-based, you know, every 4 years, every 2 years, so on and so forth. And full-spectrum practical politics is engaging and taking out an opponent or a system or a corporation, so on and so forth, by any means necessary under the rules or under the laws, but never breaking the rules or never breaking the laws. But to understand anything, we first have to teach you practical politics, which is non-voting politics. The first basics are the art of staying on point or using a talking point and being able to say it over and over again to make your point, not arguing, just making a point. But this is an introduction, again, to Follow the White Rabbit, and Follow the White Rabbit is a game that will teach you practical politics. Start your grinning and drop your linens. There's another MP3 up, and then this is it. I'm going to do some interesting things in this one. The first thing I'm going to do is we're going to walk back in time a little bit, because I've talked a lot about Russia and how a critical role Putin has played. At least he's a front man for something. Very critical role, but we're going to walk back in time. And I'm going to talk about a strategy that's been played right in front of your face, but maybe you haven't seen it. I'll call it passive engagement. That strategy got a little more aggressive. And as time went by, I'm guessing it started in World War II, but again, we don't know the past, so we don't know the future. There's some big questions about World War II and how ended and what happened right after that. Most of my listeners know that by now. I mean, they're waving stuff in front of everyone's face, and we'll go into that in a little bit in the media. I'm going to talk about some media stuff in this one. But what I want to do first off is I want to give you a brief news update and talk about the strategy played out. What we saw after the crash of 87 was really the beginning of a challenge for our enemies. Our enemy had to have its spiel set up by that time, around that time, or so they thought, and they were going to use that, in my opinion, as a way to set that up. You know, there's a big problem. The problem is with capitalism. So the reaction solution, we've talked about this. The challenge was they didn't have, something's always happened to them. You know, give them everything but their New World Order. Give them everything but their New World Order. Passive engagement. Passive engagement. You act like you're their partners and you give them everything but their New World Order, because when they're at the top of things, they become blind. But what I'm going to do is something that most other people haven't done, maybe you haven't had done before, but something I do is I'm going to dig out a piece. This piece was ran in a paper called The Exiled. Theexiled, and it's by an author. He's basically a liberal named Mark Ames. Excuse me, but he does something very, very well. He talks about internal goings on within Russia. He's done this the whole time, and he's caught on to a few things. He doesn't really see the picture on race, and he never will, because he's a white rabbit. We already know this. But he does talk about some things that the average person in America, he wasn't actually a journalist in Russia, in Moscow, and he knows the internals quite well. But in this piece, and you can go read this piece, this was first published in November 13th, 2003. I've always watched his stuff because it seems like he's very bright. You know, there's a lot of conservatives out there that won't read liberal stuff because they assume that, oh, he's a liberal or he's this or he's that, and there's libertarians that won't read either or. Well, I look at everything. If I think someone's onto the truth, well, you know, I'm gonna pay attention to stuff. But he's someone that's been on my radar screen a long time. He's a pretty famous author in Moscow. He had to skedaddle out of there for certain reasons. But it's an interesting piece. It's called The Real Reason Why Putin Arrested Yukos Oligarch Mikhail Khodorkovsky and Exile Classic. And this was first run on November 13, 2003, so he was on the ball. But this is when things started speeding up. This official event in the White Rabbit history was when passive engagement became extremely active. You remember I told you things started spearheading when Putin came to power. He came to power wide sky.
which is kind of like we always come to power, and he was in power. He was entrenched. He didn't get elected until 2000, but by the time someone gets elected, it's done. And in 2003, the knives came out. But how he did it says everything. It is basic passive engagement, and then he set them up for the takedown. And I'm going to read you this. This is the real reason why Putin arrested Yukos oligarch Mikhail Khodorkovsky, an exile classic by Mark Ames. Very good piece. And I'm going to read you some parts of it. Let's see here. In this article, I'm going to focus on two things. And the reason I'm doing this, the reason I'm reading this article is because he says some things better than I have, because he was a journalist there at the time, and he's looking back. He wrote this shortly thereafter and put this together when this was happening. And this would happen, I'm guessing, the summer of it started in January, building up, January 10th of 2003, and was executed during the summer. But I think it's important for my listeners to understand. In this article, I'm going to focus on two things, and of course, I am reading this article. Yeah, this is Horace reading. What led to the crackdown and what it means for Russia. Using the Visio, he says something in Russia, which I don't speak. I decided to let the surface, a highly underrated phenomenon in politics, speak for itself when it comes to describing what led to the crackdown. I went back and did a Moscow Times Google search on articles relating to Yukos and Putin. What emerges is a surprisingly clear, almost linear drama that doesn't quite correspond to the narrow frame created post-crackdown. If you read through the chronology, you pretty much have the picture of what was at stake, what strategies were employed, and how the game was won. I'll start with the chronology of articles in the Moscow Times beginning in January 2003, and I'll end this timeline with the arrest of Khodorkovsky's deputy, Platon Lebedev, in July 2003. Read this, and it becomes clear what really happened. Now, he doesn't extrapolate anything about German soft power, and now he doesn't, this is me interjecting, he doesn't extrapolate anything about race, which is kind of common. He doesn't see everything, but, you know, who does? I don't either, I just look at the trends. January 10th, oil majors say government impending exports. Top oil executives have lashed out at the government for hindering their ability to cash in on skyrocketing crude prices and engendering production growth by failing to unclog export routes. And then he goes on to say, January 28, 2003, and I am kind of abbreviating. You can easily Google the piece and look it up. January 28, 2003, Kremlin big oil on a collision course. Russia's powerful oil barons are locking horns with the government in a high-stakes battle over new export routes that threatens to alter the economic and political landscape of the country. Yukos CEO Mikhail Khodorkovsky reacted with impatience to Kasyanov's warning last week, slamming the government for moving toward what he called a Saudi Arabian-style government of overblown bureaucratic control. Now, I'm going to interject here. What was happening was that Putipu came to power, but he didn't have he didn't control all the oil yet. He wasn't in control, and at the top of these oil companies, you got to remember, were Pink Rabbit banksters and elitesters, the famous neocon oligarchs. And he had kind of singled them out and took control of the media and took control of this and that. But there was one powerful layer, a representative from London left, Mikhail Khodorkovsky. And they hadn't put the screws to him. And what this piece is talking about basically is how he set this up. And it's kind of funny. February 17th, and this is me reading again, Transneft claims pipeline victory to triple BPS capacity. Yukos chairman Mikhail Khodorkovsky on Friday repeated the offer to take the responsibility for building pipelines off the government's hands. See, you want to put things in private industry's hands. If you don't have the money to build the pipelines, let us do it. The cabinet, meanwhile, has shown no willingness to relinquish control over the country's export routes. You see, the Kremlin controlled export routes. What he was trying to do is put the export routes in private hands and make himself more powerful. This is February 17th. This is me reading again. Putin says Gazprom too powerful to break up. Gazprom, as a strategically important company, should be kept and has been kept as a single organism, Putiput says. February 20th, me reading again, tycoons talk corruption in the Kremlin. The so-called Union of Oligarchs rolled into the Kremlin on Wednesday night to chat about corruption, a problem the president said needed time to fix. So what? This is me interjecting. What he was doing is Mikhail Khodorkovsky was trying to say there's a problem with corruption in Russia, and he was trying to engineer for another political coup to try to get Putin out of the way. That's me interjecting. Yukos head Mikhail Khodorkovsky said the government must be willing to show its readiness to get rid of some odious figures in the government to prove its readiness to combat corruption. Yeah, I mean, he's telling them how to combat corruption. This is funny stuff. Even though corruption is one of the hardest crimes to prove, Putiput also took the opportunity to fire a few shots across big business's bow. This is when he started becoming lippy. I would like to hear concrete suggestions from you about what we should do, not just criticism. I know there's going to be criticism tonight, but I too can criticize. This is Putin talking like this, and this is when he started talking back. Khodorkovsky said he and other business leaders share some of the blame for government corruption. You can say that it all started with us, the Associated Press quoted him as saying, well, it started at some point, now it must be ended. The situation has come to a head. So he's kind of admitting, you know, and Khodorkovsky is one of these guys that admit, look, there's going to be corruption here, but we're willing to work with it, with this stuff, and we're willing to try to fix it. You know, he's trying to be cooperative. And Putin was just playing, you know, Russian possum. March 11th, Transneft seen constructing oil exports. State pipeline monopoly Transneft is not building oil pipelines quickly enough to handle rising output, forcing Moscow to face continuing domestic gluts and a cap on significant higher exports, Alpha Bank said Friday. The Kremlin, you see, was controlling export routes. That creates a problem. That problem's going to get a reaction from Khodorkovsky, because he wants total control over that in private industry, which almost makes sense from his hand, but it doesn't make sense from Putiput's hand. March 12th, this is me reading it, FSB looks an awful lot like the KGB. President Putiput announced that the Federal Security Service, or FSB, will take over the entire Federal Border Service and parts of the Federal Agency for Government Communications and Information, or FAPSI, F-A-P-S-I. This is a big event. You see, a lot of this time, Putiput was looking weak. Why his moves behind the scene were anything but, he was consolidating power. March 14th, 2003, crucial pipeline call put off. Crucial pipeline call put off till May. The cabinet on Thursday delayed choosing between rival pipeline projects aimed at supplying energy-starved economic giants Japan and China, saying it didn't yet have enough information to decide. This is Kremlin stalling. But with powerful oil major Yukos backing the China Link, and gas giant Gazprom, and state-owned oil major Rosneft pushing a dual-oil gas Nadhotka, Link, the government is looking for a compromise that will please everyone. They were basically stalling. Ilyarionov urges private investment pipelines. Russia's oil major gas network should be built and operated by both public and private companies, not be kept as a preserve of the state. President Putiput, top economic advisor Ilyarionov, argued Friday. Good cop, bad cop. He's trying to balance things. March 27th, risking it all for a couple billion. I don't have to go to the president anymore to ask whether there will be a redistribution of property. This is what Khodorkovsky said. Now I go to the prime minister and hammer out details for pipeline routes. As he tells it, he too has undergone a transformation. Society expects not only success, but social responsibility from its most high-profile members. March 28th, Nemtsov supports pipe dreams. At the packed Moscow news conference Thursday, Khodorkovsky and Nemtsov joined forces to lash out the government for slowing down on rooting out corruption. Now, meanwhile, Khodorkovsky, this is me interjecting, is talking about corruption. Of course, the only corruption he's talking about is that which is in the government. You know, he's at the top now, so he wants to control the government, basically. And he wants the government to root out corruption, but, you know, nothing neoconish, of course. And I'm going to skip to April 10th, United Russia's French party line. Moscow Times editorial. United Russia recent proposal that the party or parties that have a major majority in the State Duma should be allowed to form the next government. Then it goes on to say some different political machinations. April 14th, and I'll read again, Japan offers to fund oil link to Siberia. Energy-starved Japan is willing to help fund the construction of an oil export pipeline from Angarsk, near Lake Baikal, to Nadhotka on the Sea of Japan, Prime Minister Viktor Krishtenko said Friday. April 17th, Putin wishes Yukos a happy 10th birthday. Putin congratulates Yukos on the 10th anniversary of its founding, the Kremlin said. April 18th, private pipeline gets state funding. The government on Thursday ended its opposition to private oil pipeline projects, saying it had agreed to study an area an ideal to turn Arctic Murmansk into a vast oil port to boost supplies to Europe and the United States. May 19th, Pooty Poot lays out the next 7 years. The president's also stirred up political buzz with a kicker at the end of his speech when he promised to consider forming a cabinet of party members loosely based on the results of December's parliamentary elections. It's a highlight was Putin's vague prom. The highlight was Putin's vague promise to consider forming a professional, effective cabinet based on parliamentary majority, an ideal that has been bounced around among pro-Kremlin lawmakers for months. It's kind of like a French-style republic they were talking about or something like that. It was basically, come on. May 30, Japan fumes over China's deal with Yukos. Japan sent a top energy envoy to Moscow. It was China's top energy, you know, basically China and Japan were kind of fighting over energy resources because they don't have any. June 11, 2003, what's a scandal all about? Until recently, something of a scandal erupted over reports published by the Council for National Strategy attacking the oligarchs. This is when it started coming to a head. There's a series that was set up coming into this. Recently, something of a scandal erupted over the report published by the Council for National Strategy attacking the oligarchs. The CNS states in its report that representatives of big business are preparing to transform the system of government in the country with the aim of achieving personal union of big business and executive branch. In reality, the country is on the verge of a creeping oligarchic coup. You see, Kartakovsky was setting up a political move where he could take the top of the presidency and then control big business, kind of like America, and then get their new world order, that type of thing. It was one of the last hurrahs they had. It is interesting that Kartakovsky is mentioned, or it was actually the only option they had. Let me be honest with you. It is interesting that Kartakovsky is mentioned in the Lathy CNS report 10 times and Yukos 25 times. In other words, the report was first and foremost targets Kartakovsky and Abramovich. It is these two, according to Diskin, who are the insidious ringleaders plotting against Putin. One of the most damning accusations leveled at Kartakovsky in the report is the following. According to the plans of a key member of the ruling class, as early as 2004, a new government may be formed under the control of and accountable to the parliament. The front runner to be the prime minister of such government formed under a new constitution is considered to be Mikhail Kartakovsky. These guys were making big moves. June 23rd, or so they thought. Putin says poverty's still the enemy. I don't like the word oligarch, said Putin. This is what he said. This is, quote, I don't like the word oligarch. An oligarch, in our general understanding, is a person who has stolen his money and who continues to steal by taking advantage of his access to power. I'm doing everything to make sure that this situation doesn't repeat itself. I don't see these kinds of people, but maybe someone who's trying. As to reports of the impending oligarchic revolution, Putin said he was satisfied with the relationship between tycoons and state. Today, those who disagree with this position are, as they say, long gone, he said, referring to exiled tycoons Boris Berezovsky and Vladimir Guzinski. When asked by journalists from way out in Russia, Vladivostok, about possible routes for a new pipeline to the east of Tab Asian markets, Putin said he was leaning toward the route from Angarsk to the far east port of Nadhotka, over a rival route backed by Yukos that would go directly to northern China. Putin's dangerous personal preferences. July 2nd. And this is the title. In general, over 3 years of Putin's presidency, the elite has become more militarized, less intellectual, and more closely linked to business. Given there is no real separation of powers in Russia, so on and so forth, Russia has handed big business an unusual role, providing some form of checks and balances. Head of Yukos' parent company arrested July 30th. This was Platon Lebedev. And Lebedev was one of the first arrested with Yukos. The director of Group Menantap, the majority shareholder in Yukos oil major, has been arrested on suspicion of embezzlement dating back to 1994. Prosecutors announced Wednesday. They're going back, all the way back to the beginning, 94. July 7th, head of Yukos, it's a Kremlin study. Kartakovsky said, if I wanted to be a dissident, then I would probably do that instead of business. Now, the author goes on to write, and this is very good. When viewed in hindsight, there is a clear thread, a conflict which boils down to a head and finally comes to a resolution with Putin's strike against Yukos in July and his apparent victory. If we can trust the surface event, this conflict is not a simple tale about Kartakovsky funding liberal opposition parties, as many Western reporters now argue. And if you frame this as a facile mafia turf war, thieves swiping from other thieves, you're just cutting out all the meat and muscle from this incredibly rich high-stakes drama. And that's probably one of the best observations of any journalist in my lifetime. about this event. Instead, taken as a narrative, what you see developing is this. Yukos flush with billions in cash and basking in a sudden international glory as a model Western-style company begin to flex its awesome newfound power. The heart of the battle seems clearly to be control over oil pipelines. This is where Yukos' economic interests clashed in a zero-sum game with Kremlin's power interests. Yukos led, they were trying to hand everything to China because, let's face it, America did the same thing. That's me interjecting. Yukos led a kind of oil major rebellion against the Kremlin, lobbying to privatize the state's oil pipeline monopoly so that Yukos would be free to export as it pleased. In a sense, it was attempting to disarm the Kremlin. Khodorkovsky proposed building private pipelines favoring the world's two biggest powers, America and China, making it in those countries' interest to lobby the Kremlin to open up the pipeline network up as well. Khodorkovsky was gathering all the might of international capital and political clout into one grand alliance on his side. Also, I think he was talking about running some pipeline to Israel as well, but they didn't mention that. I forget all about that, but that was in the works as well, you know, free energy to Israel or something. Meanwhile, the Kremlin seemed to hem and haw over its final decision on how to apportion the pipeline networks and policy. I'm going to read that again. Meanwhile, the Kremlin seemed to hem and haw over its final decision on how to apportion the pipeline networks and policy. While Putin appeared to dither, Khodorkovsky upped the rhetorical ante. He seemed to have decided that the only way to get the oil pipeline monopoly broken would be to launch a broad attack on the government, charging it with corruption and bureaucratic statism. It also seems likely by the surface reports that he really was pushing for a power structure change that would have empowered the parliament and the government at the expense of the presidency and the Kremlin, basically. I'm surprised how few people remember, myself included, how the idea of introducing a French-style parliamentary system was being lobbed around in the early spring, an idea at the time which was not linked, at least publicly, to Khodorkovsky. Now, this is something that Putin publicly entertained. Now, was he really entertaining it? No. It was a clever deception. It would make sense. Khodorkovsky's fight against the state's oil pipeline monopoly was stonewalled by a Kremlin that he could not get around. Stymieing Yukos' expansion for the sake of keeping Putin's one last lever of power over the oil magnates, not to mention keeping the Kremlin's control over the big pipeline piggy bank. Putin's opening address at Gazprom in February, where he said the natural gas monopoly was too strategically important to break up, foreshadows how he will eventually resolve Yukos' attempts to crack the oil pipeline monopoly, held by the Kremlin, of course, me interjecting. This came to a head in the oligarch's lobby group meeting with Putin on February 19th when Putin snapped at Khodorkovsky. I would like to hear concrete suggestions from you about what we should do, not just criticism. Still, for the most part, Putin seemed either indecisive or at times differential. He seemed at the time to have been humbled. Oh, poor little Putifoot. Indeed, even his own political party had stated to suggest a change in power structure of the government. Clearly a feint to give Khodorkovsky the impression that he was triumphing. I'm going to repeat that. Clearly a feint to give Khodorkovsky the impression that he was triumphing. Reading this, I remember thinking earlier this spring that Putipoot was looking weakened, and Yukos looked like it would somehow rule Russia and perhaps half the world. Now we can see that Putin was simply in a strategic retreat. It was a classic judo move. As Yukos lobbied harder and grew more powerful by what seemed week to week, Putin gave the appearance of caving. In his State of the Union address, Putin himself offered up the possibility of transforming the power structure toward a French-style republic. He wished Yukos a big happy birthday, and then when the time was right, he struck. You can almost feel his pent-up triumph, after all, must have had to endure while drawing Khodorkovsky in, when on June 26, just a week before Lebedev's arrest, but a few days after the attack had already secretly begun, he said, "I don't like the word oligarch." There is something truly admirable and scary about Putin's methods. It works every time, because if there's one thing he knows when battling against brilliant, powerful opponents, like neocons, it's their biggest Achilles heel is always their hubris, which is a classic kind of pink rabbit trait. And his style of operating is always to encourage that hubris to swell up. I've often heard insiders claim that Putin in real life is an indecisive man, nothing like the strong man we see on TV. That may be true, but I bet that playing the role of indecisive mediocrity when dealing with powerful interests behind the scenes serves Putin just as well as appearing decisive and strong in public. After all, that strategy worked for Stalin. interesting piece, and I'm going to discuss this a little bit more. But this strategy of passive engagement, putting them to the top and then hammering to the ground, is a strategy you're going to see employed across the board post-2003, and we're going to go into that, especially post-2008. What happened in 2008 was Georgia. It was the hammer. It was basically they were hammering shut someone's New World Order. And maybe not for the average Pink Rabbit Bankster and Elitesters, but for the ones that count, it's over. It was over with then. They're in a fight. A fight now for everything. And we're going to continue this conversation, but the piece I read to you says it all. And you can look that up, and I'll give you the title again. The Real Reason Why Putin Arrested Yukos Oligarch Mikhail Khodorkovsky and Exile Classic. It's by a paper called The Exiled, E-X-I-L-E-D, and it's there's an interesting writer on there called The War Nerd, which is a pretty bright war historian. And this is a piece by Mark Ames. That's A-M-E-S, Mark Ames. And I'll be back with you in a second. We're going to discuss this a little more because this is very important stuff you see happening right in front of your face. And so how does this strategy apply elsewhere? Well, we're going to jog around the world here, and we're going to go over to Brazil because Brazil was also supposed to be part of their New World Order. And Brazil has done something interesting as of, I'd say, right after the first of this year. Boris Berezovsky, who's sitting in London, he's kind of exiled from Russia, and Russia wants his deportation. He had gotten some trouble in Brazil, and he was covered for up until recently. A judge, you can look up the piece. The piece, one of the interesting ones is Boris Berezovsky. Berezovsky, that's Boris Berezovsky, documents seized in Brazil will be delivered to Russia. So he had some information that was wanted in Brazil due to his criminal past, and he's got all kinds of stuff going on in his past. You can only imagine. Putiput has been after him for a long time, and these guys don't quit. That's what I want you to understand, because we don't quit. Yeah, we're going to be yelling about this attempted genocide against us. We're going to use this 1,000 years from now. Yeah, 1,000 years from now, some little white rabbit is going back in time. She's reading all bug stuff. She's listening to this. She knows that any time you see a self-hating white person, white rabbit, start doing something crazy, you start yelling and screaming that the last time you did this, they tried to genocide us. That's right. You're going to use it time and time again and develop who knows what kind of money you'll have behind you. But that's another story. That's going to be in the next MP3. I'm going to go into that. But anyways, Putiput doesn't forget. They don't forget. And Boris got himself in trouble down in Brazil there, or potential trouble. And, you know, they wanted these particular documents that were in Brazil, but Russia wanted them turned over to them. And this is, of course, and this actually, what's interesting is the most interesting piece made Pravda, and a lot of stuff on Pravda is totally, it's all propaganda, but, you know, there's no bad propaganda, just ill-timed propaganda. But this is Pravda, and you can look up Boris Berezovsky, Deep in Hot Water, and you can read it, but it's a very good piece. The order to deliver the documents and equipment came from Judge Fausto de Santos from the 6th Federal Vara of Sao Paulo at the behest of the prosecutor of the Russian Federation. Boris's lawyers argued that the order of delivery of equipment could not start, so on, so forth, etc. Basically, they're delivering the goods. What's interesting about this is your enemy always thought Brazil was in their deal. And I'm sure some Brazilians were. But what you've had is a broader rollback. In 2008, Russia defended its borders. And when that went down and there was no response, or they couldn't respond, what happened was that opened up a broader forum, and other groups started rolling back. Other groups that they thought was their partners, kind of like Khodorkovsky thought that Putiput was his partner at first, or that he could just screw him over, because that's what they do, they screw you over. What they've done is started screwing them over. It's kind of like a layered deception. You ever seen this, one of these interesting shows on grifting? Grifting is, high-level theft, and there's a series of plays. Instead of just one theft, there's like 10 different cons going on. Well, what's happened is there's 10 different cons going on, but the con artist you know, someone's grifting the grifters, someone's thieving the thieves, and so as the con goes down, someone pulls the rug out from underneath it. Maybe you've seen that, really clever, like in Ocean's 11. Ocean's 11 was about a very clever heist, and sometimes you get someone that gets tangled in their own webs, and that's what's happened. And of course, as that went down, as Georgia revealed itself, others started pulling back, kind of like a mini Putin strategy over Yukos. What Putin did was brilliant, bold, and I mean, he totally played into the hubris and everything else. Said, yeah, I'm on your side, I'm your boy, oh, I'm weak, I'm just little pooty poot, come and get me. And then he just hammered him into the ground and had him running. He ran off to London like a little gay schoolboy. And then he was crazy enough, at behest of Rothschild, go back. Why did Rothschild send his rook back? I mean, the rook's a big chess piece. You don't have Russia, you don't have a New World Order, you don't have anything. You got to go back there. It's worth the risk. And so he went back, running back, and now he's in jail in Siberia. Yeah, sure, he's getting out. He'll get out, and the next morning Jesus will come and demand all the Jews convert or cut their heads off. So if he does get out, look out. You know, that's when Putin will let him out. Sure. Yeah, he's going to get out. But that's what's funny. What's funny is that some other parties are still not getting it. Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, the power vertical. Putin crashes Medvedev's party. And this is a funny piece. And he ends it, you know, these guys can never figure out anything. In the end, all in all, pretty weak tea, made weaker by Putin's broadside. One can argue forever, and we have, about whether Putin and Medvedev have competing agendas or are playing good cop, bad cop. Remember, I told you about this. Did Putin blindside Medvedev on Friday, or was the whole thing staged to give the impression that political reform was really on the agenda? Of course, we don't have the answers yet, because you're clueless. That's me interjecting. But one thing is clear, increasing sectors of the Russian elite are beginning to sense the limits of Putinism. But it doesn't appear that they have anything remotely approaching the strength to do anything about it. Yes, that's the point. What's funny about this, now let's jump over. Let's show you what just came out, January 29th. This is like today. And of course, you know, January 29th, Paulson says Russia urged China to dump Fannie and Freddie bonds. And this is in 2008. What was happening is that why Putin, you remember Putin told U.S. President George W. Bush during those ceremonies that war has started. He's talking about Georgia. And during the whole time, Paulson, that a top-level approach to the Chinese that together they might sell big chunks of their GSE holding, that's government-sponsored entities, to force the U.S. to use its emergency authorities to prop up these companies. Well, America was already doing that. What is funny is Russia has basically, long time ago, after 2003, after the Yukos takeover, they started divesting, basically sneakily pulling out of U.S. asset or balancing off against them. And they were basically sold all its Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac bonds in 2008. They've done all this before disaster struck the housing and whatnot. Russia sold all, this is quoting Bloomberg, this is Bloomberg, you can look this up, this is a good one. Paulson says Russia urged China to dump Fannie Freddie bonds. And this is by Michael McKee and Alex Nicholson, Bloomberg. Of course, they don't see a bigger pattern, but I'll go into this. The report was deep with trouble. Heavily selling could create a sudden loss of confidence in the GSEs and shake the capital markets. And so this is funny. Russia never approached China about dumping U.S. bonds, Peskov said today. That is not the case, he said by phone. Russia sold all its, this is me reading it, all of its Fannie and Freddie debt in 2008 after holding $6.56 billion of the notes, which is kind of nothing, at the start of the year, according to central bank data. Fannie and Freddie were seized by regulators on September 6, 2008, amid the worst U.S. housing slump since the Great Depression. Putin seemed combative and fun. Paulson said he was surprised not to have been asked about the Fannie and Freddie bonds during a trip to Moscow in June. I was soon to learn, though, that the Russians had been doing a lot of thinking about our GSE securities. He said of his meeting with Dmitry Medvedev, who succeeded Putin in Kremlin the previous month. Putin kept Paulson waiting before their meeting at the government's headquarters and made the conversation fun by being direct and a bit combative. He never took offense, and we could spar back and forth. What Putin Company are doing after at the same time is they are getting out of any, let's call them Anglo assets. Not all of them, but they're getting out of a lot of them, especially the bad ones. And they're urging China to do the same. What is funny about this is the Russians know something, and I know something. My list, there's two sides to China. You see, China's one side was brought into the equation by the Anglo elites, in my opinion, under some deal. I shouldn't say, I should say one side of the Anglo elites, like the Pink Rabbit Banksters and Elitesters. The Pink Rabbit Banksters and Elitesters in China were in the deal. And they were investing to keep a, to keep a bubble up. What happened after the crash of 87 is they, you know, you came out with things like all kinds of, you know, they started intervening. There was a direct intervention by the Fed with liquidity after the crash of 87. One of the challenges, let's go back to a private central banking scheme and the differences between a private and a public central bank. And we have a private central bank. A private central bank is a private corporation. Private corporations cannot create a true currency. They can only loan money because they're a bank. A bank only loans money. It doesn't create a true currency against the goods and services and the productive capacity of its people. What Anglo banking is, what the U.S. Federal Reserve is a private central bank. They can only loan money. A bank can only loan money. It can create the principal, but it can't create the interest. And under this system, the interest grows. And so what happened at the crash of 87 is you have a direct intervention, and they kept constantly fooling. Post September 1987, you've seen a lot of fooling around in the U.S. financial markets. And so what they did, this is my opinion, is they blew. What you have is a bubble forming in U.S. hard assets. And as the bubble started, a little hole came in the bubble. Let's say you're blowing up a balloon, and the balloon's big. It doesn't pop, but it ruptures a little bit. It has a little hole in it, and the hole starts seeping, air starts seeping out. Well, what you can do to keep the illusion of that balloon being big is you can blow it bigger. And then, of course, once you blow it bigger, it gets the little hole is still there. The air seeps out. But as long as you're still able to blow air into the balloon will still hold air. And so what they've done is they've been blowing air into this balloon that's like U.S. assets using house, whether it be the stock market or housing assets. They've been blowing air into the balloon. The challenge was that your average economist thinks that, you know, all my life they've said inflation is going to pick up. Well, that's not the problem you suffer from private central banking necessarily, because as long as they're keeping air flowing into the balloon, that air is going to go somewhere within the balloon. And usually it doesn't go into hard assets necessarily like wheat or grain or anything else. And we've seen a blow up of financial assets, which has given the illusion of there not being any inflation. It is a weird, weird mix. But as long as they kept air blowing in the balloon, and one way is to print money, but there are other ways. You know, Bernanke, who was just confirmed, the U.S. Federal Reserve Chairman, for those white rabbits that don't know, he was just confirmed, faced a lot of heat, which is interesting in itself. I mean, this guy almost didn't get confirmed nearly. And one of the reasons he faced heat was actually all these challenges. But the challenge itself is with private central banking. Because they can't pay down principal. They can only loan money. And under this system, the debt has to grow. It has to grow and has to go somewhere. And they keep recycling it back as air back into U.S. assets and so on and so forth. But they needed a partner to keep this going. So the Chinese came in, the Chinese Pink Rabbit Banksters and Elitesters, another element in this. So what the Russians are doing is the Russians are going over and sticking their finger in their eyes as well. Because they can't sell GSEs. They can't sell any U.S. assets. Any more than if you're my partner and you're investing in my enterprise, it doesn't matter whether you're Pink Rabbit Bankster and Elitester on Mars or whether you're in America, you have to support each other. Right? And so he's going over there sticking their finger in a certain group of Chinese eyes. And what's funny about this is now you've seen a big war break out in China between Google and China. Well, I don't really know what all to make of it because China is wide sky, but there are two groups there. And in my opinion, a group has pulled it over on the other group and done another rollback strategy. Because within China, it's been very controversial on why they buy all this junk from the U.S. They're buying junk assets. I mean, they have all kinds of money and they are doing legitimate investments within China and around around the world. But there is a group there pouring money into junk U.S. assets. I mean, they own junk. They were openly buying bonds in government-sponsored entities. You have strawberry pickers. Strawberry pickers were getting housing mortgages that they couldn't in any way pay, and they knew it, and they were investing in this stuff. Why are they doing that? Well, you got to always ask the why. Well, they were part of something bigger. And so not only is Putin dumping his GSE assets, his government-sponsored entity assets, in 2008 at the Georgia War, he's telling them to do the same, knowing that they can't do that. That's what's funny. You know, there's another side in China that does nothing but wants to do business with us and that type. They're good people. You know, they're not necessarily bad people, but the Pink Rabbit banksters and leasers are pretty much... Well, they're in trouble. But anyway, so they have this big bubble, and as you blow up this balloon gets a little hole. But it doesn't matter. As long as the hole is not too big, as long as the bubble doesn't pop out right, you can keep pushing air into it. The problem that's coming now, right now today, January 29, 2010, you can't hold it back anymore. They pumped so much air into this thing, and what has happened is the unthinkable. Instead of there being a surplus of U.S. dollars, you see, under this system, everyone always said, well, there's going to be a surplus of U.S. dollars, and everyone's going to be running around, and the price of food, we're all going to have wheelbarrows full of money to buy bread. It's never once worked out that way, has it? No, what's happened is there's a shortage of dollars. You see, they can't. The dollars are like air. There's only so much air you can blow. Everyone needs air. There's no air. You can't blow enough air. The air is coming out of the balloon, and everybody inside the balloon needs air. All these assets linked to U.S. dollars have to have air, which means they have to have dollars, which means they have to buy dollars. And so you have to sit there behind a printing press and think of all these different ways to shove liquidity, and that's what air is. Liquidity is a wheel that keeps the market mechanism going. In private central banking, liquidity is everything. That's why you've seen the growth of derivatives. That's why you've seen the growth of... everything you could think of having to do with financial markets. Air is liquidity, and they can't push enough in there. You cannot, if you do the experiment, you cannot keep blowing in the balloon indefinitely. You can huff and puff and make big blows, but the air is going to start seeping out, and you're going to have to get ready to do it again. Well, they've been huffing and puffing. All their partners have been huffing and puffing, and now the air is going to really come out. Not only that, but you have wide sky elements, even in the Obama administration, that want to tax stock and derivative transactions. And that will be the end of Anglo banking right there. That will be the end of private central banking, because that kills liquidity. And so what I'm letting my view interest, the people that have listened to me, especially the first 24, if you have any questions about what I'm saying, just go back in time. Because the setup that's happened is very clever and very ingenious, and it's across the board. It's not just in White Rabbit's sphere. Other groups are in on it too, and it's been very, very comedy to watch this come about. And of course, I try to let my listeners know on what I really think's going on, at least things that they can easily follow for themselves. But this is happening right in front of everyone's face. It's just you got to be looking for it. But if they go into some type of transaction tax, it will be annihilation for private central banking, because what you tax, you get less of. If you tax stock transactions, if you test derivatives transaction, it will be Armageddon overnight. But then they're going to war. They're getting ready to go to war. It's not if but when. They don't have any other option. And after that war, we've already discussed this. It's going to get interesting. But if any of you have any questions, any new listeners, you got to listen to the first 24. I wanted to do separate pieces, and where you could just listen to and not be dependent on the first 24. But with this happening so fast, it's becoming, this is one of those pieces for the listeners of the first 24. So if you're lost, you can go back and listen to them. They're free. They're online, and they're yours. And of course, we just had on January 29th, released by Wall Street Journal, Russian police raid environmental group's office. So anyone gets on Russians' nerves, they just raid them and say you did some kind of a tax offense. And then we have the maximum opus. And this came out January 26th. This is old news, though. This is, I'll read Stratfor. Stratfor, S-T-R-A-T, F-O-R. You can get a free, sort of subscription there. And their intelligence is, they don't take into account race. They don't take into account anything. Do they? They don't take into account long-term preservation stability of white rabbits, but their analysis is okay. The analysis this time is A-OK. And let's see, Ukraine's election and Russia's resurgence. They're just now noticing. Let's see, November 24th, and I'm reading from the November 2004, the result was prolonged international incident that became known as the Orange Revolution. That event saw Ukraine cleaved off from Russia's sphere of influence, triggering a chain of events that rekindled the Russia-Western Cold War. Next week's runoff election seals the Orange Revolution's reversal. Russia's own first candidate, Viktor Yanukovych, outright and his workable agreement is owned outright, basically, and has a workable agreement with the other, Yulia, which is the female, Tymoshenko. So no matter who wins, Russia owns one of them outright, and they have the other one. The next few months will therefore see the de facto folding of Ukraine back into the Russian sphere of influence. Interesting. And, of course, this has happened, but what they don't mention is the obvious German soft power. What they don't mention is all the setups that took place before this, so on and so forth. And, of course, going to war, Clinton missing speech, but not as a security holdout. Hillary, you know, our real president, I guess, is over in London discussing the real problem, that is the big war coming. Yes, a big war. And I'll be back with you, and we're going to discuss some media topics, some interesting media topics. But I thought it was important for my listeners to see this setup, because most of you don't see this setup coming, this rollback strategy. And it's been a brilliant strategy, because when you put them at the top, they appear to be blind. They have blind spots. If they have a little alien god here, he has big blind spots. Heavens knows what we have coming. That gets me excited. But asking for the anti-rabbit. You know, all these Christians I talked before about, I just saw another sign. You know, Obama's the anti, you know, this stuff just doesn't quit. But I hope he is. Obama's the anti-rabbit. Oh, that's wonderful. That's fantastic. But these Christians get me excited. You get me excited, little Christians. But anyways, we'll go on, and I'm going to talk about the media. I'm going to talk about some events in the media. And I'm going to go back over something I think it's important for you to understand. And so as this rollback strategy has happened and accelerated post-2008, 2003 seems like a big year for me. 2008 is very big because we're accelerating into, of course, 2012 and whatnot. Especially, I mean, 2008, you're not going to be able to start holding things together. You're going to have more and more problems. Crash of 1987, they've had more problems, but post-1998 especially, they've had problems. That you've seen it. I mean, you could see it in front of your face. They're having more and more problems holding this garbage together. All the garbage and this banking garbage and everything else. And of course, that's just one part. There's also racial problems. There's all kinds of other problems they've had because none of their stuff works. If you go against nature, eventually you're going to have problems, and someone's going to take advantage of that. But in my opinion, they've never once taken advantage of it by direct confrontation. The first time would have been 2003. Putin came to power, some stuff happened, but no one could get a good read. And then 2003, the plan came out. In 2008, the fangs really came out financially. And now, of course, elements in China are rolling back on other elements in China and are doing some other creative things. The flames of the East are in action, as I call them. Brazil, across the board, you've seen this rollback strategy. People that were supposedly on their side are not necessarily on their side, that type of thing. The average Pink Rabbit banksters and leasers, there's elements of them that look like they're very disheveled. Some look scared, some look uninformed, some look confused. Other elements are plainly terrified, but this should be interesting to see how all this comes down. And of course, I expect something a little bit larger than most of you have seen in the past. But anyways, as this whole period has happened, another thing has happened, post-2003, especially post-2008, we have all the Nazi channels, the Hitler channels, even comedians. Comedians are talking about the Hitler channels. The Sci-Fi channel is now a Hitler channel. They got another special on escaped prototype U-boats, all kinds of stuff. It is overwhelming. And, you know, we've got other, you know, so I get emails almost every day from someone talking about there's a new film called 1488. Kind of interesting. You can YouTube it. There's another one called Blood Creek, Town Creek, which I didn't see. It was about a Nazi occult researcher who ended up in America out west way back when and found Nordic runes that could give him eternal life. pretty freaky stuff. And he, you know, it's like a horror flick, Nazi horror flick. It is. I didn't even realize how much was out there until I talked about it. And I get these emails all the time, and it's kind of never ending. But there was one big event. There was a big event on Mystery Quest. I'm guessing it was Mystery Quest, but there's so many Hitler channels, I don't know anymore. I'm going to assume it was Mystery Quest. It was Odessa and the Fourth Reich, and they were talking about the rat lines, and they were walking you through and talking about the escape, certain escape routes out of Europe into South America. And they talked about it. Very convincing stuff. They didn't just talk about it. They're affirming a meme. Now, let's go over this. White Rabbit Media, all media, not White Rabbit Media, all media will exist to do three things. All media will exist, that means all propaganda, all media, period, will exist to do three things. It will show you what has been, it will show you what will be, it will show you what is going on now. Not necessarily, you know, what you see is what you get kind of way. I'm going to repeat that. All media is there to show White Rabbit what has been, what will be, and what is going on now. Now, of course, a legitimate media is going to have a lot more what you see is what you get type things. You know, this media is kind of wide sky, but even that, it's become overwhelming. Now, when you're coming back to a meme is like roses are red, violets are blue. You've been told this your whole entire life. There's a recurring meme underneath the surface, you know. Well, that flower died. Well, no, the flower didn't die. Roses are red, violets are blue. You know, they both lived. Roses are red, violets are blue. They're still alive. Eventually, as you come back to this meme, this noise gets louder and louder. Oh, you got to show them roses are red. You got to show them violets are blue. You got to affirm the meme. Affirming a meme is when you actually visually show white rabbits, because white rabbits like to see things. Some elements of white, I'll go on a brief tangent here. Some elements of white nationalist media or racialist media have always been individuals. They do cartoons and stuff like that. I'm never really critical of that because what they're doing is overwhelming white rabbits visually, and that's always what you want to do. You never affirm a meme with a white rabbit without overwhelming them visually. So I don't really make, well, plus I've actually been on a bus with a lot of non-Europeans who can say anything they want with white rabbits, especially in Europe. I mean, it's illegal for them to even say anything in defense. If some little kid in the United Kingdom, they can't do anything except get online and laugh at jokes and laugh at cartoons published in America, racial cartoons that would be, you'd be thrown in jail for that in Germany or UK. So I don't really say anything about that. It's not on my website simply because my website's only about white rabbits. But there is one consistent ideal that you've seen from me, pretty much from the get-go. I tried to get going. I overwhelm you visually, or I at least attempt to. Very unique concepts, and I visually bring those to life. Or I didn't, the artist did it. And I've tried to do that. That's what you have to do with white rabbits. You have to overwhelm them visually. But, you know, there's always been a lot of controversy behind racial cartoons in America. And they have their place in some elements of what I will say propaganda. There is no bad propaganda, only ill-timed propaganda. But anytime you've heard the type of things said to me, actually from white people, you know, the only ones that really get bent out of shape over racial cartoons are actually white rabbits. They get all upset over it, especially overseas ones. But, you know, I think that says it all. You know, but they don't say anything when some little kid in the United Kingdom has to ride a bus, can't say anything for his own defense, and gets knifed to death. They don't say anything over that, but yet they're worried over some racial cartoon getting published on some nefarious website in America. I don't really get upset over that because it has its place. If it didn't have its place, it wouldn't be there. You won't see a black rabbit on my site, and you'll never see any like a Mexican rabbit, simply because this isn't a show for them. Our stuff, whether WhitakerOnline.org or whether WhiteRabbitRadio.net, and there are other ways to find me. Yeah, I got HoraceTheVenger.com, HoraceTheVenger.org, HoraceTheVenger.net. But the one you see is WhiteRabbitRadio.net. But you can get there from all those. HoraceTheVenger.com, you can get there as well. They'll all take you right to me. But one thing I do is I don't allow anything that doesn't concentrate on white rabbits in our current struggle, because there's attempted genocide against us. And some of that stuff gets you off track from my particular message. But that doesn't mean I think it's a bad thing. My artist did a black rabbit It is about the funniest thing I've ever seen, but I won't put it up there. Doesn't mean someone may not sell a mug with it on it or something. It doesn't mean you may not see it somewhere, but you're not going to see it on my site, because then it would add why, you know, you don't even discuss them. Well, that's true. So it's kind of a waste of time. But all this stuff has its place, you know. But when you're coming back to a meme, and there's been a steady meme that the Nazis survived, I don't care where you're at on this planet, it's getting louder and louder. And as they've come back to a meme, they're starting to affirm, and you affirm visually. The one mystery quest, Fourth Reich and survival of Odessa, they walked you through streets of Europe. They big maps of all their routes and all this stuff they showed you. But then there's another one, and it's a very important one. It was Ghost Hunters International. And I had people email me and say, well, it's kind of lame. You got to understand what they're doing. They're not doing something for little Nazis. Yeah, little Nazi emailed me and says, that was kind of lame. Well, it's not for little Nazis. It's for your average white rabbit. What they're doing is something profound. They're not only showing you in certain episodes of this stuff where the routes they took, but they're showing you where they went. Ghost Hunters International starts, which is a weird show to put it on, in South America. They were hunting Hitler's ghost and Nazi ghost at a Nazi hotel at a little city, Hotel Vienna, somewhere in South America, somewhere in Argentina, staffed by a bunch of people not from that town, who had a big plastic surgery wing, and they're taking you around, and they are overwhelming you visually. Your average white rabbit watching that is going to be pretty blown away. Now, wait a minute. They actually survived. Not only did they survive, there's a hotel there with the plastic surgery wing. And then, you know, some of the people were upset because the producer's name is Jennifer Hutchins, and I thought she did a brilliant job because the woman's taking a risk. I mean, you have Ghost Hunters International. They have all the ghosts in the world to hunt, and I don't watch this. It's the only time I've ever watched this show. All the ghosts in the world to hunt, all the haunted castles, all the weird closed-down sanitariums, all the odd things they could do. This lady picks a Nazi international, a Nazi hotel, in South America, with a plastic surgery wing. And on the beginning of the show, for the first 30 seconds, they probably should have had him on for a minute, but no more than a couple minutes. They had a man named Harry Cooper. Harry Cooper's not just an author, he runs Shark Hunters. Shark Hunters is affiliated with the U-Boat Museum in Germany. Of course, they didn't tell you all that, but Harry Cooper's his name, and they talked about a book, Escape from the Bunker, that he published. I don't think he didn't author it. That they announced him as an author, but he published it, and he did the foreword to it, and it was written by a Spanish spy that helped, that rode in the U-Boat with him. With Adolf Hitler or whatever. They proposed this. So they're affirming a meme that the Nazis lived. Elements of them had lived somehow. I mean, they're pretty much blowing this in front of the average person's face. And they're coming back to a meme that Hitler survived. But they're coming back to it in a little more convincing way. Obviously, we didn't see his ghost, and you're not going to. I don't really buy into all that stuff, but I'm a skeptic. There was one part of the show where they announced if there's any Nazi ghosts, come out and change the color, and they had this little light switch, and they could go, two blue lights, two green lights, two red lights type of thing. It was kind of freaky. I don't know how they pulled that off. But, you know, anyways, but the hotel was actually in pretty good shape, which surprised me. You could actually probably make it into condos or something. But they didn't really use the guys from Shark Hunters that much. They only had them on for 30 seconds, but what they said in that 30 seconds was that Hitler escaped and came to this hotel according to a book they published from a Spanish spy. Well, that's a pretty radical statement for international TV. Considering that all the stuff that's come out afterwards, they're proposing some very radical things, and that's something you can't really do. You have to do it in a roundabout way, and what they're doing is something very clever. They're doing it across weapons, about different weapons platforms, but this is a very interesting way to go about it. But they are overwhelming you visually, because eventually they got to show you stuff. That's just common sense. Yeah, eventually, if you said roses are red, violets are blue, and they are real. Well, eventually you gotta show them those. You gotta show them that they're red and blue. And that's what they're doing, but they're doing it in a very clever way. And the lady who produced it, in my opinion, put her neck out. Because putting something like that together, when she put that together in Hollywood, is pretty dicey stuff. You gotta have some balls to do that. Yeah, the show's gonna get good ratings. Yeah, but she has a lot of other things. You know, not everyone is naive. Not everyone is stupid. Not everyone's going to say, gee, that's just so accidental. Yeah, they're hunting Nazi ghosts. I mean, of all the ghosts to hunt, why that and why now? So you should always ask why behind something's written. Why is something being done? And I've tried to give you a heads up on this stuff. And, you know, you should be awake to it to some extent, or at least try to be. But anyways, it's kind of entertaining. And the lady, I'm sure, is taking a lot of heat because on one end you have the shark hunters, the historians say, well, you didn't go far enough. You should have had Harry Cooper on there for 5 minutes. That's 10% of the show. 10% of the show, this guy's going to talk about a diary from a Spanish spy that said Hitler escaped. Meanwhile, they're showing you where he escaped to, supposedly. And by the end of the show, any average white rabbit watching this, that's the only people that watch that show, yeah, white rabbits, is going to know that something Nazi stayed there. There's no doubt in anyone's mind from what the townspeople said. And all the third-party stuff is pretty overwhelming, but it was very visual. So that's a good little lesson in propaganda. When you come back to a meme, you've got to overwhelm them visually. When in doubt, go eye candy and go with a lot of it. And they're going to keep doing that, I guess. But this lady's taking heat from both sides because you're not going to please anyone. There's another section in Hollywood that you can only imagine. What on earth is this? You know, no one even knew about that. Where's this coming from? You know, and who knows? Poor Miss Hutchins. But I sent her an email and said she did a very good job. Yes, she did. And, you know, as good as you can expect to do with a given topic. How would you like to have that job in Hollywood? Yeah, you're going to do a Ghost Hunters International, Jennifer, and you're going to introduce the fact in 30 seconds that Hitler not only escaped, but they published a diary from a Spanish spy who helped him escape on a U-boat. And then you're going to run around Argentina and spend time hunting Hitler's ghosts and Nazi ghosts in an actual legitimate Third Reich, or as I should say, Fourth Reich hotel in Argentina called the Hotel Vienna. And you're going to do this, and of course, we don't know really what's going to happen about this, but you got to go down there and film that, and, you know, it's a pretty dicey proposition for someone out of Hollywood. You got to have some gall and everything that rhymes with gall to do that. So she did a good job considering the circumstances, but she didn't do it, obviously, for the little Nazi crowd. But this is for the average rabbit. It's kind of funny. It's a classic lesson in how this stuff is done, and it should be interesting to see the full machinations because we don't know the past, we don't know the future. I know you don't know the past, you don't know the whole story. I don't care how smart you think you are. But this is all shaping up, and this is kind of interesting. This is kind of fascinating stuff. So we should see this come forward. And in my next piece, I go into a little bit of a media on an event that happened, an event that that I've been expecting because we're on time, and being on time is very important because you don't want to ever go against time. Timing is more important than knowledge and skill. Timing will make you look like a genius or make you look like a fool. There is no in between. But that's a little lesson on what I think about the media. And never forget, that's what they're there for. The media is there to tell you what has been, what will be, and what is going on now. And everything's pretty much wide sky, but at the same time, they're breaking memes. They're breaking memes and affirming memes and coming back to memes. You know, they came back to an old meme that Hitler lived. I didn't see his ghost. I didn't see any evidence of that. But they're affirming a meme that something survived. And it was pretty overwhelming. They did a very good job of that. But when in doubt, if you're affirming a meme, you want to get a point across, go visual. Forget all the writing on racial and stuff like that. That's important. There's nothing wrong with that. Whatever your job is, you want to be very visual. One of the challenges is our media is so dominant. We have the most dominant media in the world, but we don't, you know, they don't really have a budget. Some of these guys that run these older websites, they don't have a big budget. Most of these websites, most of the guys, whether it be Bob Whitaker, David Duke, the steely-eyed lone wolfer rabbits, they've been online since online was online. You know, these websites go back to 95, 96. And it's very hard to redo one of these websites with all that information and merge to a more or visually pleasing site, even though many of them would probably like to, simply because the site is so old. I know that's one of Stormfront's problems. Stormfront's is huge, but it's so big, and they don't have some huge tech staff. So imagine merging to a new software. It's not as easy as people think. But my site's on WordPress, so I can constantly redo stuff. So if you're redoing a site, go WordPress, because a lot of other, there's a lot of good stuff out there on WordPress, and you can always, do a lot for your money. You know, NewsNet 14 bought a template that $50 or $100, and their template looks like Time Magazine or something. But on WordPress, with a click of a button, you can change the look, which is kind of cool because in 3 or 4 years, my site may be outdated, I may be doing something new, and I may need to change the appearance, right? Well, you want to make that easy on yourself. And if you've got a lot of information, and the racialist websites, the average racialist website has more information than your major Fortune 500 company. We have a ton of information online. We own the net. It's so pervasive, we own martinlutherking.org. You know, if it'd kind of be like if the Anti-Defamation League owned davidduke.com, or the Anti-Defamation League owned, you'd be in trouble. We own Martin Luther. When you got a new form of media and a racialist like Don Black, whether you love him or hate him, but he's a racialist, and they own Martin Luther King, one of the Martin Luther King sites to put out their message on Martin Luther King, you got trouble. Now, yeah, they could take back the internet media. They could they could bring out the anti rabbit and get the red hippo out to beat us, to try to fight us directly, and they could take down all the internet media and take whiterabbitradio.net and all that from us. But that, you know, his reign ends pretty quickly, doesn't it? So I didn't even worry about that, but it's a little late. You got to worry about that in 95, 96, 98. But that's what arrogance does to you. When you get to the top and you're arrogant, our enemy is very arrogant. You have blind spots, and they can't see correctly. They can't focus. And then when you're dealt body blow after body blow, sooner or later you become very disoriented. And then you're only interested in survival of your money or survival of your family and that type of thing. And that's one of the challenges with elitism, with another form of wordism. But that's what's happened to them. That's what you're watching. And I guess Putin's attitude would be, well, if I have to live with them on this planet, which I should at least get the psychic satisfaction of watching them fall from a very high level. That's an interesting point. Interesting way to look at it. But in the next piece is on media, and I go on about this type of thing. This piece has been a little bit longer, and 30 will be out actually pretty quickly as well, because I got other topics I need to hit on, other things I need to inform you, other things I need to talk about. Back into blog type stuff, and probably even having to answer a few more questions because my site is getting a little bigger. But I'll be back with you guys later, and there is a piece coming after this all about media and a very important event that just happened. I'm recording this particular segment on January 28, 2010, and this is for my regular listeners and those that have heard the first 24 podcasts. The 24th was done officially, put together completely on December 20th, 2009. And in the first few, I talked about how dynamic sound is and how you cannot unhear something. And that everything starts with a sound and a vibration. I told you a lot about practical politics and how this stuff works. And there's one thing that it should do. It should start working quickly. Well, that makes sense. If you're going to bring out a commercial or make a run for the border, if it's catchy, if it's going to work, it should work. And I wanted to bring something to your attention. It's again, it's January 28th. I've been getting emails about new listeners that just found my show. They were listening to a show over on the Voice of Reason, Reason Radio Network. Voice of Reason, it's called. It's a white nationalist, modern conservative, basically all around decent radio website. They have several different radio shows. They have the Nickel Rant with Edgar Steele. They have the Sunic Journal. They have the Orthodox Nationalist, who I like. If you want to go deeper into Russia and learn about all the different interesting details on some different Russian events, that actually I filled you in on a lot of it, but I just filled you in on the directions on what you needed to know. But if you want to go into detail on Russia, the Orthodox Nationalist, he's a very interesting show. You'd probably enjoy that. But they're over at the Voice of Reason. And they got their act together. They got a very nice website, and they have some very, very good shows. And of course, one of our partner sites, White News Now, is run by Jamie Kelso, and Jamie Kelso Shore is there every single day. And they do their thing. Peter Shanks, War of Perception, so on and so forth. But there's a show there, by one of the guys that helps run things, or both of them, I guess. I don't really know them that well, or a whole lot about them, but the show is called Mischko and Dietrich. That's M-I-S H-K-O-N Dietrich, D-I-E-T-R-I-C-H. And that show is January 22nd, 2010. They do a three-hour show, and it's titled This Week in Disorganized America. And they're talking about Haiti and everything going on right now. But they have call-ins. And at the 2-hour and 30-minute mark, shortly thereafter the 2-hour and 30-minute mark, now this is a 3-hour show, if you listen to it, and you should, if you're a student of this show, if you're a student of practical politics, a lady comes on there. Her name's either Marie or Maurice. She's a Southern lady. Says she's a baby boomer. Says she woke up after September 11th, 2001. And she started listening, getting information online, wondering what's going on out there, what's happening. And then she started becoming racial. And she started, basically talking about, they were talking about Haiti and the IQ of nations. She made a few interesting arguments about their IQ scores and how they're not going to be able to, typical, really good racialist arguments. But then she made a point. She started making your point. She went right into a consistent message. I mean, right into consistent message about this attempted genocide. She talked like a normal Southern lady, very persuasive, very, very good job. She mentioned my radio show, that the listeners might like to hear it. Thank you. That's wonderful. But this is precisely how this stuff works. I do not know her. I will never meet her. But she did a brilliant job. Whoever you are out there, you did a brilliant job of making your point. Not only just making an argument, you can make a point with an argument, make an argument about IQ, so on and so forth. She made her point about an attempted genocide. She went so far, and this is a baby boomer that hasn't even been woke up 10 years. She went so far as to say that the good guys lost World War II. I thought that was pretty profound for a baby boomer. Very profound stuff. You can hear it for yourself, though. It's Mischko and Dietrich, January 22nd, 2010, Voice of Reason. Voice of Reason at Reason Radio Network. You can pull it up. You can download it. Go to the two, or listen to the whole show if you like it. It's a very good show. They're on every Friday. I don't have time to listen to all our white nationalist shows simply because all the racial media, our racial media is so dominant. I'll get to that in a few seconds, but this is a great example of practical politics, non-voting politics. She's exactly the type of the Patriot Tards, the InfoWars type guys that got going really big after September 11, 2001. She's the type of person that came on board, type of person that's looking for something. If you go out of your way to include women, and I didn't do a whole lot other than point a direction, I point people in directions, but if you include women and give women tidbits, they will hold down a consistent message as good as a man. One of the challenges you have with men is that men, and I've talked about this, men, we gotta know whys, we gotta be entertained, we gotta know all this extra stuff. Women just wanna do what works, and if they do it and it works, they'll keep doing it. They're very simple, and they will run their mouths. Yeah, they will run their mouths for us, which is good, which is fantastic. But that's Maurice, I believe is her name, and you can listen to a nice, well-spoken Southern lady, very convincing, very convinced herself, obviously, that she just did it her own way. But she is obviously a listener. But that's precisely how this stuff works. And my 24th show, the whole entire first series, wasn't even done a month before she came on there, and January 22nd. And so, I haven't even been out roughly even six, 7 months, and that's assuming she heard it in May or June or July. I mean, I didn't have that many out really till August, September, and October, November starts getting interesting because I moved over to a snazzy new website. And then December, the first series is done. You got a nice new website. Everyone's got a lot of stuff to listen to if they like it. Very interesting because that's precisely my target audience. I told you exactly what surprised me is that she's a baby boomer. It shouldn't, but it does. But it doesn't surprise me she's a woman. But she did a really brilliant job of making her point, and she believes what she's telling you. But this is exactly how this stuff works. It doesn't matter whether it's now or 1,000 years from now. It doesn't matter 1,000 years ago. It's just practical politics. It's the basics. The basics always work. That's why they call it the basics. You doubt this stuff until you see it work. It is very, very dynamic, very, very fast moving. Sound is not as fast as light, but sound is all we got, and everything starts with a sound. Once that sound is in the air, once it starts being repeated, it is extremely violent in a system. All closed societies are brought down with sound. They're brought down through a consistent message at a right time, and the place just crumbles, just starts crumbling against itself. It is wild how fast it can happen, and actually terrifying if you're certain parties involved. But it can happen that quick. Now that is just a white nationalist show where she's making her point. Obviously, if there's one like her, there's more out there like her. But if you have a good consistent message, if it's done by someone with some talent. And obviously, whether you like those guys over there at Bugs or not, you would come to the conclusion that someone there has a whole lot of talent. I mean, even old Bob, you can find out that he was hired by some of the biggest hitters on planet Earth, and everyone knows his politics. Yeah, he does not hide his politics. He's the guy that will sit down at Washington and will give the one line or the one sentence that will just jaws will drop at the table. That's what he does. And he did it for a living at the highest level you can. But when you have guys like that over there that know their stuff, that are putting stuff together, by the time I come in and start putting something together to put you on a consistent message, it should work. I had my homework together on what Maurice would like to hear about, World War II and other things like that. And that's precisely what she's talking about. So my research was right, and so far I'm doing my job. At least it tells me we're on the right direction here. But that's precisely what I should be hearing, because I was asked, you know, some guys say, well, it won't happen that fast. Well, you don't know what you're talking about. When it's time, it's time. The Berlin Wall didn't come down in a day, but yet it did. It's the way things work, but it's a great lesson in practical politics. So go over there and listen to that show if you're a fan of this show or interested in how this works. And I don't know who this lady is, but that's precisely how it works, because everything's boiled down to a simple. It's not Bob's mantra. It's not the mantra over there at Whitaker Online. It's our mantra. And, you know, these talking points are for anybody. The reason I'm in character is not because I'm afraid you're worried about you're going to find out my name. I could care less. I'm in character because we want you knowing how practical politics works. So to demystify that, I demystified old Bob. Very easy to do a lot of research on. At the same time, I didn't want anyone thinking they had to thank me. You don't have to thank me. I'm here to do my job for you. But if everything's lined up right, that's precisely what you should see, and that's pretty quick. I think we can agree it's pretty quick. It seems quick. But it's no quicker than a good commercial getting you to run for the border to get over the Taco Bell. No different than that. It's just time. It's time. It's time for change, as the Talibama says. But I wanted to let my listeners make you aware of that, because it is a great lesson to something I've been talking about now just for a handful of months, really. You know, this has not been out that long. And our media is dominant. Yes, I don't care whether you're a hardcore, steely-eyed lone wolfer like combing some of those hardcore racialist sites like over there at resist.com. Doesn't matter whether you're InfoMedia, altermedia.info, which I now got posting rights there. I post when I put out a new show, because all our stuff is legal. They're in Europe. They're in Belgium. So, you know, you got to watch what you say there. But that's our job. Our job is to tell you what to say or let you know how to say anything you want to say and make it legal. You know, there was a congressman out in California that said, you know, he's a racist, he's American, then racist. That's fine for California, at least today it is. But in Europe, I never want anyone saying that. You say in your opinion I'm a racist. You're just saying that because I'm white. Anti-racism is a code word for anti-white, because if you don't, you're probably going to go to jail. Now, it's the same thing, of course. But that's the whole point. That undermines a closed society. You know, if you're out in America, you can dice roll on some of that stuff. If you're an old timer, you say, well, that's fine for you. But we don't want anyone going to jail in London. And they will put you in jail for London if you say, I'm a BNP member and I'm a racist. At least they will today. I don't know about 10 years from now or next month. Things can happen very quickly. But you don't have to go to jail. We can show you how to say the same thing and make your point over and over again, and they can't do anything about it. And it drives them crazy. This is nightmare. That's a nightmare scenario. To have a lady baby boomer grab a consistent message written by a very talented group of people, putting out by the silver tongue himself, yours truly, H. Avenger. That's exactly what we want to see. That's not what your enemy wants to see. Because this is a very radical lady that said the good guys lost World War II. It's a pretty radical adjustment for a baby boomer. Yeah, and I made fun of baby boomers. They make fun of this lady. This lady's on the right team. That's right. But our media is dominant. I mean, a dominant, dominant, dominant. They're going to start playing Follow the White Rabbit on live radio or on Stormfront. I'm not going to be live, I don't believe, but they're going to have all the different episodes because I got enough stuff out there where it can be played. You can do what you want to with it, you know, but they're going to start playing it supposedly on Stormfront, which is fine with me. I don't have any rules about that. They can do what they choose to do. And that is a big forum. It's in the top 10,000, 3,000 websites in America all the time, and those numbers may not even be accurate. These websites, and they've been out, you know, even the National Vanguard sites and whatnot, they've been out since 95, 96. I mean, you know it's bad when the owner of Stormfront owns MartinLutherKing.org. Yeah, if you look up MartinLutherKing.org, one of your racialist allies are going to be putting out a message on that channel. Yeah, you know you're in trouble when your enemy owns your own channel, owns one of your channels. It'd be like a racialist owning CBS or NBC. You're in trouble. And he's owned that since day one. So that's how clever they are. You know, some of these sites has been, Bob's sites, old Bob Whitaker, WhitakerOnline.org, has been out since 2001. However, he was writing on several other sites prior to that as early as 96. So all this stuff, everyone saw it very early and got on board. You know, resist.com, some of the hardcore racialist sites have been out since 95, 96, and they go back to the bulletin board days. You know, Don Black was on a bulletin board as well with Stormfront and other things. DavidDuke.com, these are big sites. You know, if you were to take, I was asked, you know, by someone thinking to do a website, because I'm very, very new in putting up a website, or, you know, someone like me talking online is pretty unheard of. The things I talk about are very unique. It's obviously, someone has done their homework. At least, you know, I know what my audience is and I'm starting to reach them. But I've never really done anything like this. So I was asked how difficult it was. I said it was frighteningly simple. Bob's assistant, helped put out stuff at first, put stuff together that I had done, and then helped put it out. But, you know, I put up one website by myself, and then the other one, the WordPress site, I put it up, you know, all basically with some help, but by and large, this isn't rocket science. One thing I would recommend is that there were some comments about some of our, like, altermedia.info. They don't look as good as they should or something like that. But one thing you got to understand is that our media is so dominant. Our media is so dominant, and it's been around since day one, that migrating to new sites isn't exactly easy. One thing I would suggest, if you go to Voice of Reason Radio, or if you go to mine, you're going to see WordPress. Bob Whitaker is on a WordPress site. Anyone on a WordPress site is very easy to redo the face of. It's a click of a button. You can add a new look. You know, move stuff around very easily. In other words, you can change the whole entire appearance with a click of a button. Newsnet 14 is, you know, someone, there's a direct link on my front page. It's a very interesting site full of racial news simply because it looks so professional. It looks like Time Magazine or something. And that is a WordPress skin that he bought for $50 or $100. You can buy them. They're very inexpensive for that professional of a looking site. Mine was actually free. It was, it's a standard WordPress template I found and then kind of put all the graphics on it. We put the graphics on it and try to make it as professional as possible. But some of the old sites, you know, like altermedia.info, that's in the top 3,000 websites in Germany, and some days it's in the top 1,000. I've heard that it's in the top 500, depending on how you look at it. And they have all these different, if you go there, altermedia.info, there's a link on my front site. We have direct posting privileges now, so I can put up a show, when it's getting posted, and, anyone on altermedia.info.us or maybe even across our main site will see that. And it's a big deal. It's in one of the top, it's a news feeder site. So they don't do anything. No one there writes anything necessarily, but they let others there do write or do put out programs, post there. But they got to meet a lot of rules because it's in Europe, but it is a huge site. Top 3,000 websites in Germany every single day. That's big considering they don't make any money. Our stuff is huge. Our stuff is so big that when Ultramedia.info wanted to migrate to a different WordPress template, they couldn't get anyone to agree on it. You know, the Germans have one of the most dominant sites in Germany, so they had votes, and then they're starting to vote, and then the Norwegians wanted a different template, and they can't. But it's very easy if you have a WordPress site to put up new skins, to redo your cover. You know, if it's getting dated after 3 or 4 years, you can redo it real easy. That's one good thing about it. Since I'm new at this, I'll tell you my experience. So it doesn't matter what business you're in. If you're putting up a website, I'd go with WordPress because you can get stuff done for it. You can get information on it. It's pretty easy. It's pretty standard nowadays. And you won't ever have to worry about migrating to some new look or something like that and being a total epic challenge, because we have there's some websites like even DavidDuke.com or even real hardcore racialist websites with all the funny cartoons and stuff like that, like Resist.com. They have tremendous amounts of information on there. There's more information on these sites than your average Fortune 500 company like Ford Motor Company, who has a whole entire team running their website. They have a whole entire high-paid tech team running their website. These guys are running their websites with just a handful of people. So migrating to something like WordPress or migrating to a new site would be a lot of work. You know, Ford Motor Company migrating to a new site, they have a whole teamwork on that for a while, and they don't have near as much information. Think about that. Think about how much information we have online. Martin Luther King's website, one of the main web links, is owned by the owner of Stormfront. And that it's our message about Martin Luther King. That's funny. That's dominant. That we are dominant in the media. We dominate media. We dominate the only media that counts. If you don't dominate online, you ain't going to dominate the future. Yeah, so, you know, someone wrote in and said, you mentioned Tesla was the white rabbit of the future, and they nominated Shockley. Shockley, you know, put the silicon in Silicon Valley. This guy's a big deal. William Shockley, and I'll spell his name correctly. It's Shockley. And that's William Shockley, Shockley. And he invented, basically, he put the silicon in Silicon Valley, and he was a racialist. Yeah, he was big in eugenics. A brilliant man. And that is a Shockley Semiconductor and all that stuff. You can look him up. Look him up in Wiki. He's a giant of our race as well. So maybe I spoke too soon. Tesla's the future. Shockley's the here and now. Because without the silicon, there is no Silicon Valley, and without the Silicon Valley, and without William Shockley, you ain't got none of that, and we don't have no internet, and we're not dominant in the media. So that's something to get excited over, and this is how this stuff works. But by all means, if you're migrating to a site, migrate to WordPress. And if you have one of those old-timers with one of those sites with, all kinds of every single issue that a racialist want to look at, we have online, but that's a lot of information to migrate to a new site. Because someone was talking about, you know, some of these guys have older sites, and if you're not on WordPress, migrating to a new site is a full-time job. I know what an automotive company, like a Fortune 500 company, goes through migrating sites, especially if you're migrating to, with WordPress, you want to change your skin, you want to change the look, you can buy a template or, cheap $50 template, which they look very professional. Go to NewsNet 14, and you just hit a button and you can change some stuff. But if you don't have that, it's a lot of work. It's a lot of work. The old way is work. But that's pretty funny. We're so dominant. We have Fortune 500 media numbers without a Fortune 500 budget, without a tech budget, without anything like that. But we dominate things. And everything else comes after that. I mean, once you're dominant in the media, eventually you're going to dominate everything else. That's kind of common sense. If you're not making money, if you're a racialist and you haven't made money, and you most likely haven't, that doesn't mean you won't. But that's how that works. Ultramedia.info, you'd think they make a fortune, or Stormfront make a fortune. Some of these guys make a fortune. Well, they probably will someday. you know. But that is interesting, our media and how dominant it is. And, you know, it's so dominant, and these groups are looking for certain things that someone like me could come out with a consistent message. And in just a period of actual days, so many days from when I started, not even 365 days, you have a little white rabbit baby boomer lady who pretty much hits a consistent message as good as you can hit and made it her own. Totally impressive. So that's something, I don't care if it's now or 500 years from now, pay attention. It's always practical politics. If you win, it's because you're doing something better, and it usually has to do with consistent message. But you always have to tailor things for white rabbits, because race is real. But our media is dominant, and that's something to be proud of. It is. It's really ridiculous how dominant our media is. And I'm a newbie to the media. How about that? But it's fantastic, and the reason I can do something like that is because you got to have avenues. Altermedia.info letting me post new shows on there, and the reason they're letting me post new shows on there is because they're dominant, and they need someone that obviously, none of our stuff even toes the line, even in Europe. You know, you could say, in your opinion, I'm a racist. You're just saying it because I'm white. Anti-racism is a code word for anti-white. You could say it in Europe all day long. They can't do anything about it. They'll go nuts, but they can't do anything about it. So that's, they're right up our alley. They have old Bob Whitaker's articles on there, stuff from WhitakerOnline.org, the blog. You can post that on there all day long. That's why they like it. You know, it's not against the law there. And they have some weird codes. You know, being white is pretty much illegal. Yeah, it is. But our media is something to be proud of. You guys that were around from the beginning, I don't care what your politics are. I don't care, I don't really have any enemies on the racial right. But it's just amazing. The ideal that we could own Martin Luther King's site, that a racialist could own it, to put out the message on Martin Luther King, whether you like Don Black or not. He owns a site and he puts out a consistent message on Martin Luther King, the other side of the story. It's funny. It's funny. But that's a little lesson on media.
This is the end of another episode of Follow the White Rabbit. Follow the White Rabbit, again, is a game that will teach you practical politics. Practical politics is practical because it is non-voting, which makes it very, very practical. Conventional politics is voting politics or rule-based politics. And the ultimate, of course, is full-spectrum practical politics, engaging and taking down an opponent, a system, by any means necessary, within the rules, within the law, but never breaking them. And this is the end of another episode of Follow the White Rabbit. Thank you for listening.